Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whittaker-Large, and I'm here to help you create a profitable HMO portfolio. Whether you're a brand new investor or you've been at it for a number of years, my podcast is here to help you make the most from your business, whether that is starting up, scaling, or systemizing. Please hit the subscribe button to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you've got an awe-inspiring project, an inspirational investing story, or a unique approach to HMOs, I'd love to hear from you. Hello and welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whittaker-Large. In today's episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have a very special guest. I've known this particular individual for a number of years now. In fact, she's been one of my inspirations in developing my own property portfolio and also doing a mentoring program. Her name is Susanna Cole, and I'm sure that you would have heard of Susanna because she's extremely well known in property circles. She's the entrepreneur and founder of The Good Property Company. In fact, she's more than just the founder of The Good Property Company. She really is an entrepreneur. She's got business cut through her like a stick of rock. She helps folks to launch and grow their profitable property portfolio business through a step-by-step system, which she's developed over the years. She does flipping, deal packaging, property investing, and raising finance, all of this to enable people to achieve financial freedom. She launched The Good Property Company as a deal sourcing and JV flipping company and unbelievably sourced over 200 deals at a value of £45 million for an agreed price of £30 million. And the most amazing thing, she did this in less than 5 years. Her first 42 flips sold for £402,000 more than expected. And she has raised and fully paid back thousands of millions of pounds in private finance. Very impressive. Today, she helps property investors from startup to experienced through her flagship online 60-day academies and other online property programs. She lives now both in Barcelona, near the Mediterranean, and Bristol, where her substantial property portfolio is based, and she enjoys traveling this wonderful world we live in. So, Susanna Cole, very big welcome to you to the Ultimate HMO Success System podcast.
It is so nice to be here. We have known each other quite a long time, and I'm very, very excited to have a good chat with you today, and you're looking fabulous.
So you too.
It's gorgeous to be here. Gorgeous to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very, very welcome, Susanna. It's been a delight. When you said yes, I was very, very delighted to know that you'd be coming on. One of my first questions to you was, how did you get started in property?
Through some bumps. I think maybe you can resonate with that as well, where you have an idea, you have a plan, but you know there are some things in the way. And I think most people get started either from a push or a pull. So the lucky ones start with a vision board, and this is what I want to do, and I've got lots of money. The mere mortals among us start with, my current situation is not what I want my life to be. So you move away from that pain, don't you? And I had two little ones. I was head of household. So my month and my money, I think there was a £10 difference. So I had £10 a month to spend on myself, which was great, but maybe not quite what I wanted in life. And the most important was I was working corporate jobs. And so quite understandably, from their point of view, they were taking their ounce of flesh. You know, so if I worked harder, they wanted more, and they wanted more, and they're reasonably senior jobs. So whilst those were enjoyable experiences in so many ways, I just sat there thinking, I'm just on a treadmill. This is a machine. I'm just a piece of flesh, and I'm completely dispensable, as is everybody else, because it's a FTSE 100 job. So I'm not being negative about them, but I just recognized my place, which was an interchangeable human being. And that's not what I wanted, because I wasn't spending enough time with the kids. And that £10 a month wasn't very much fun. You know, there's no security in it, really. You know, so I started to look at models. And the model that I thought was really sensible, which your listeners are probably going to agree with, is property. You know, that rich dad, poor dad, employee, self-employed business owner and asset owner. And I thought, well, as fast as I can get to being the asset owner, that's financial freedom. That's me living a life of choice. So it was thinking about, and also I love property and I love creativity and I, you know, love all of that kind of stuff. So that was my thinking. And then I had about 18 months where I wrote business plan after business plan, didn't do anything at all, listened to speakers, read lots of books, and didn't take any action at all. And then finally I tipped over and started taking action. So lots of delays in my start.
Very interesting listening to you, because you're clearly a very capable woman, independent minded, focused, driven, obviously at that point a single parent as well, so you had that added responsibility. And yet there must be hundreds of thousands, millions of people like you, Susanna, who only have £10 left at the end of the month.
Yeah.
So your story really resonates, I think, with people who may well be in a corporate job or earning quite good money, but unfortunately they just find the position where, as you say, they're in the rat race. They're constantly kind of fighting to keep up.
Yes.
And it seemed like your dissatisfaction with that lifestyle or that result at the end of the month was what spurred you into taking action.
Yes, it was. And and part of that was I bought a bit, you know, I kept buying bigger and bigger houses for us because I was kind of raised that way, you know, property and we're British and everything. And part of it was being the head of household, that there was a fairly substantial cost of childcare while I worked. But yes, that dissatisfaction, I think it was both the money, but I've never been mainly financially driven. It was also the instability. Once you get to a certain level in a corporate system, understandably, if you're not performing, you're really impactful, or if they take a change of strategy. And I saw our head of sales, I was director of a radio station, so, you know, fairly sizable job. And I saw our head of sales, whose skill was amazing, I saw her job be removed. And at that point, I thought, she's extraordinarily good at her job. She simply wasn't a strategic fit anymore, or rather her job wasn't, not her skills. And so it really taught me a lesson that you can be really good at your job and you may well just be out of the strategy.
At that point, when you had that realization that, yeah, it wasn't just about the money, but that would be a very nice icing on the cake. It was also perhaps about family security, about legacy, about developing an income stream that didn't perhaps rely on you swapping your time for money.
Yeah.
What did you do first? You mentioned reading and studying. Yeah. Once that period of initial examination was over and you kind of had made the decision, what was your next step?
It was twofold, really. So I delayed. I don't want to underestimate that. I delayed. I read some more and I wrote some more plans. I wanted it perfect. It isn't ever for perfect, folks, by the way. So don't delay. Don't waste your time. Always delay. I was a complete ninny. I then did a little bit of education and I got myself a mentor. And I just felt that kind of backup, that confidence backup, was really helpful. And I just held my nose and jumped in and bought my first little tiny flat, like a little one bed flat with a tiny little kitchen in the living room for it was worth 120 and I bought it for 80 grand, which of course is a perfect and then I painted it myself and I watched the drug deals happening outside the back window, because it wasn't in an amazing area, although the area came up really quickly. And I was terrified buying that flat, and then within 30 seconds, because it only took 30 seconds once I got the keys from the estate agent to see my entire empire, I was like, oh, let's do this again. So once I'd understood the principle of buying discounted, refinancing, renting out and going again, I thought, well, this is a rinse and repeat strategy. So terrified, 30 seconds, oh, seen the whole empire. No, I can do this again. And then it was, right, we're going. So that just tipped me into action and I went for it.
Fantastic. Is this still a strategy that you use today?
Yes, it is. And it took me, you'll be appalled at me. My very first HMO. So I very much believe that you create good quality relationships with estate agents. I'm generally a person that does what she says on the tin, woman of her word. And one of my very main embarrassments was I actually withdrew early on from buying an HMO. And I'm hugely embarrassed by that, because it's not my preferred behavior. It's not who I want to be. It's not who I normally am. I was just too scared. So I'm so sorry, Wendy, but I was terrified. And I withdrew from this HMO, which was another ninny move. But it took me, I think my seventh property was an HMO. And after that, I switched entirely to HMOs because it was so blooming obvious.
Yes, absolutely. But I think that just the same as you, I was the same. I think I had 5 single buy to lets before I moved into HMOs. And although I know lots of people want to jump straight into HMOs, it's actually incredibly useful, I think, to have had a bit of experience in ordinary, what we might call vanilla buy to lets. Because, you know, you learn the language of tenancies, you learn the language of property, you learn the language of transactions, you become familiar with, you know, who you should use, who's the good solicitor, who's going to actually transact for you fast and keep you up to date with the process of the transaction. You get to know a better mortgage broker. They might not be yet a commercial mortgage broker, but somebody who may well be also into commercial mortgages and be able to offer them, but also is a good communicator and gives you the best deals. So actually, those early properties, probably the same as yours. I've still got, I think we might have sold one because, again, we realized it wasn't actually as good a deal in reality as we looked at on paper. But all the other properties I've kept, because they just work. And like you say, once you've got infinite returns from a property, why on earth would you sell?
That's right. That's right. And it does. It also teaches you to move from an emotional relationship with your tenants to a quality professional relationship with your tenants. You know, early days, I had one young girl whose partner was quite violent and we're installing alarms and police and da 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 da. And I got very concerned about her. Whereas these days I would signpost, but keep it very professional. So yeah, you just learn. You learn your repeatable, good quality behavior, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I love also the fact that you treat this as a business, that you quite quickly saw that you could scale it. You could do it again and again and again using the same principles, perhaps with, you know, different types of property and in different ways. Yes. But it was always about adding value to be able to extract funds, to be able to then rinse and repeat.
Yes. Particularly because of that background where cash flow was so tight that and I had sole responsibility. So if I made a mess of the money, you know, the ship fell over. So and I ended up doing 2 different types of HMOs. I started with professional HMOs and then I switched to student HMOs. So it's really interesting the difference.
Absolutely. Yeah, we might come back to that one. That's a very good point for people considering it. It's worth recognizing they are quite different beasts.
They are with pluses and minuses. Yes.
So, Susanna, you had 2 young children when you first started to toy with the idea of using property as a way to change your life. But I'm sure there must have been other influences in your life prior to that that had given you this drive, this inclination to be an entrepreneur, this mindset of being an entrepreneur. Who were those people?
Well, in property, they were the people that I met early on in my journey. And in business, they were the people that had helped shape me at the very beginning, because years and years ago, when as a very young woman, I had a fair trade business and Prince's Trust came in and they gave me, you know, bank managers who were my sort of advisors and accountants that helped me. And they gave me a mentor who was the chief exec of a shop that had 70 outlets, whereas I ended up growing mine to 5. So that was my first dip in the toe of I'm a kitchen table entrepreneur scrabbling and you're showing me some formal processes. And I'm enormously grateful to the Prince's Trust. And I got a £40 a week grant. Oh, how cute is that? That shows how old I am as well. Interestingly, in property, my inspiration was actually the people that had written books, occasionally the people at the front of the room. But my real inspiration to allow me to feel I could do it were the people I met in the room, particularly happened to be 4 men. But it would have been wonderful had it been 4 women. So David Bartlett, who still runs a fantastic property business today, I think you probably know him, lovely guy from Wales. Nigel, who's a private landlord, but very, very good quality guy, you know, really great systems. Lee Dunning, who's in Wales as well and is now running a property and brewery, and a very dear friend. I mean, I can't count all these guys friends now. Anthony Davis, who was one of my very, in fact, he invested in my very first HMO. He lent me the money. which was very kind of him because I didn't have any and I paid him back. And what was really good about these guys is they were ahead of me on the ladder, but I could see where they were. So they were multiple rungs ahead of me, but they were real and it was tangible. So rather than kind of big picture inspiration, they were almost, and I don't mean small picture, but they were small picture inspiration for, wow, if a living, breathing human being can do it, then maybe so can I. So I found those guys more inspirational, and we met up once a month individually to keep each other accountable, which was incredibly kind of them because I had no property and they'd loads.
Yes, but they must have seen something in you. They must have seen the germ of a woman who was going to grow something.
Or maybe they just like, oh, I can't get rid of her. And they still haven't been able to get rid of me now, 15 years later. I count them all as friends. Yeah.
And I think that's so true because many of us, I think, feel that we've got to be big, you know, property entrepreneurs or property business owners to be able to offer anything to our people who follow us, and we might have a tribe of people who like what we're doing and they're inspired by what we're doing, and we want to have this multi-million pound property business. But I think it's definitely worth remembering that who you relate to, who you can relate to, is often somebody who's actually just a couple of steps ahead of you. They don't have to be multi-millionaire property business owner.
All these guys were by that point anyway, although they were all very humble actually, and so they were very open book about their businesses, which was incredibly kind. And then do you remember when I came on your day and you combined property and well-being? And that's
yes,
a really interesting way of thinking, because I sort of, you know, having had these four guys, it was quite a masculine way of doing things. And here we're opening up the more feminine way of doing things. And now I'm very much that way. You know, I have a very easy life, very at ease. Everything is very smooth. So it was kind of introducing more culture in. So I loved that day that we did together as
yes,
well.
Yes, we had a great day, didn't we? Because I brought my yoga teacher along. Yes. She did a yoga session, didn't she, in the afternoon?
Yeah.
When would you have ever seen that on a property training program?
Yeah, but it's really saying this is a whole life. You know, this is really important that health and life is important too.
Absolutely. Also, I think that's important because property works when you're in it for the long game.
Yes.
You know, so I think for me, I've always felt that health and well-being are absolutely crucial to being a leader, a property entrepreneur, a business owner. If I haven't got my health, I haven't got any of those things.
Yes.
So vital. Let me ask you, Susanna, what do you least like about property?
This won't surprise you if I say the changing legislative landscape. So you get yourself sorted, you're completely compliant, tick, tock, tick, and then the government pulls the rug from under your feet. However, I don't spend much time moaning about it. I do think things like Section 24 are entirely unfair. And I also think it's very foolish on the government's behalf, because what they're doing is they're moving landlords out of the industry. And so, frankly, as a result, if any of my properties come up for rent, and my properties are top quartile, my letting agent has a waiting list and people are bidding on those properties because of the scarcity of good quality properties, because the legislation is taking old school landlords out of the industry. So ironically, the taxation issue, for example, Section 24, or the HMO issue with the valuation office, actually can provide some side benefits to people that stay in the industry. But it frustrates me, but I just decide to try and turn it around and say, okay, how can I benefit from this? What can I do? So for me, I looked very seriously at Section 24 and moving, because I have most of my properties in my personal name, millions and millions of pounds worth. Not all of them are paid off. So there's a millions of pounds worth of property mortgages, so hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of interest that's not tax deductible aside the basic 20%. And I said, well, what am I going to do here? So for me, I'm paying those properties off. So it really, annoyingly, just when I thought I could rest and chill, it gave me extra impetus to maintain a structure that is the best structure for me, but in a way that I'm not paying what I would strongly consider a very unfair tax.
I think that's an excellent point, that creativity as an entrepreneur is vital in this ever-changing landscape. Yes. And that's a very positive way to approach it. And your creativity has obviously allowed you to, again, stand back, treat it as a business, not to get too upset about it, say, right, what can I do to make that change? Yes. But as you would know, probably I would concur very, very strongly with what you're saying. Yes. But I'm not going to deviate into that cesspool of Maya on this podcast.
Well, I had, I mean, I'm, as you know, I'm a very practical person, you know, let's get on and do it. But I had a recent example. I was in Thailand. I've been in Thailand for 6 weeks and I was flying home with BA, and it's not their fault, but they lost my ticket. And I had to take multiple calls to get it sorted. And I looked at myself and I said, Susanna, you are not going to get upset about this. You're not going to go into a, oh, I can't believe they just did that. And you're actually going to enjoy every minute of this. So I had, for my last day of my 6 week holiday, I was taking afternoon tea at the Mandarin Orient Hotel in Bangkok, because why would you not? Yes. And my adorable sister, she was a little bit worried about my flight. So she and I did a video call, and then I phoned BA and eventually it got sorted. And I thought, well, I'm in one of the most amazing hotels in the world sorting out a business class flight. It's fine. And actually what it showed me was I then had no hangover of irritation, because these things happen in businesses. It's going to happen to be, it's good. So it really showed me not to get hooked on the problem, but to go, well, what are we going to do about this? And actually, it, you know, it's like drinking poison and hoping somebody else dies. You end up feeling a bit irritated. What's the point? You're wasting your energy.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
I don't always look at it that way. Most of the time, some of the time.
Let's talk about HMOs.
Yes.
So you got into HMOs reasonably early on because you could see the difference in cash flow. Yes. Having had a lot of experience, probably over a decade's worth of experience now in HMOs, how do you feel about HMOs now?
Like this. They're fantastic. They're fantastic for so many ways. If you think about, for the tenant, depends which style. I used to have professional HMOs and now I have student HMOs. So I switched the entire portfolio over. Luckily for me, just before the energy prices went up, so I don't pay any bills anymore. But when I was doing professional HMOs, it gave somebody a very smooth in, smooth out. Furniture's provided, bills are all paid for. You may or may not paying for cleaning, a ready-made community if you're coming to a city, you know. And it was interesting to measure. My average stay time was 10 months. So it was a lot of work in moving people in and out, because then they would find their community, or, you know, settle in a one bed or a two bed flat. They'd found their place. And they were very, very profitable. I was almost always full. I mean, a 2 or a 3 day vacancy at any one point was an absolute shock. I mean, it just almost never happened. And I decided to have a lot of en suites, so kind of a nice hotel experience, and keep my properties very well maintained. I mean, as much as I could, you know, every now and again you get something, you're like, what, quick, but generally, you know, repaint and all of that stuff. And then I switched the model to students, and I like this model. Now I'm in Bristol, two big universities, loads of colleges. So my students move in and out in June, July and August, and we get them agreed in October, November, December, January. So way 6 months ahead, or parental guarantors. If they can't provide a guarantor who owns a house, then they pay for the year up front. So they're locked and loaded. And this year we thought, well, not that we needed the cash, but actually we just don't even want to do the admin. So this year, why don't we get them to pay quarterly instead of paying monthly? And that was actually inspired by some of my students who emailed in and said, I'm getting my student grant, can I pay you for the next 4 months? Which I thought was very mature of them, actually.
And that actually is interesting, because that's exactly what I used to do when I had a student HMO. I would get them to pay at the beginning of the term. So they'd pay, yes, three termly instalments. Yes. And then you've just got one set of payments to reconcile. It saves you time, doesn't it?
It saves you time. So it's less about give me the cash up front. Let's just save time. So I like both models. I think I probably these days prefer the student model. And interestingly, the prices are even higher than the professional model. So I'm making more money and I no longer pay any bills. So it's a good model for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds great.
Yeah, I like the security of it. But I outsource, sorry to jump, sorry, I've actually finally handed over not all, but a part of my portfolio to a letting agent, so they do all the work.
Ah, well, I was going to talk to you about systems, because one of the things that I notice about you, Susanna, is that not only are you looking for great deals in terms of the cash you can make on a property, you also see the benefit in having a systemized business that allows you to spend as little money as possible on running it, so that what you're doing is maximizing the income. And that's always been one of our maxims as well. You probably know I also have a five-step system, and my fifth step is future-proofing, and it's all about that systemization, so that you don't then suddenly turn from being a property investor and developer into being a property manager. I can't imagine anything worse.
Or, you know, you left a little bit of a mess and therefore exactly. The cleaners had to go in and we've had to deduct whatever. Oh, not interested in that.
No.
And automation, do you put in quite a bit of automation?
We do. We have systems that talk to each other and automate things, so that at literally the flick of a switch, you can get a report on something, you can find out what's happening in a certain property. Yes. Incredibly helpful. And it seems that that's been something that, again, has been perhaps something that innately you brought to your business, but you've grown and developed a great deal of, haven't you?
Yes, but very much aided by third party applications, and also by some of my students who were like Matt Elder used to say things to me on when I had the mentoring program, say, well, I reckon you're spending about 140 grand a year on salaries that I spend 1.4 thousand pounds on a year. And there's nothing like a button to be pressed to think, well, maybe I should look at this.
Yes.
For example, I used to have 2.5 people that ran my lettings. I don't have any, but I mean, to be fair, now I've handed over to a letting agent, so that's not quite fair to say. But in the transition, it took us 2 months to do the automation, and about 80% of the work that was previously done manually, and of course with variable results, because we're human beings, we do mistakes, we're great and we're terrible at the same time, was done automatically through automation. So I'm a huge convert, a little bit slow, I would say, compared to other industries, but I'm a huge convert of it, putting as much automation as possible. So it probably saved me, even just on the letting side, like a good kind of 70, 75 grand in salaries.
Amazing. Yeah. Isn't that incredible? Yes. Fantastic. I think that's incredibly valuable to share that, because I do think also some people are a little bit slow to pick up on some of the tools. And it does take a bit of time to analyze the different tools and the different systems and say, well, which one's actually going to suit me and work for me? Some are a bit heavy. I think some of them are heavy to manage and take a lot of time to learn. And I think if you haven't got a very big portfolio, then why invest in something that's going to be expensive and also clunky? There are lots of tools out there that are equally good, which are much easier to learn and manage. And I agree, it gives you automation until you might decide to use a third party, which is another option as well.
There are properties that are still under management, but they all pretty much happen automatically. But I still will keep that system because it's still very good at allowing me to manage the letting agent. And one tip that worked for me was, because of course you change psychology. I was a bootstrapper the whole way through, because even though I was worth worth millions technically, you know, you're investing in property, so the cash flow is really lean a lot of the time. So I never really took on board the mentality of I'm going to invest a huge amount in something that's not a bricks and mortar asset, because the cash flow was always so tight as you're building. But I actually invested in paying them to do a lot of the installation of the tech for me. Best thing ever did. And I like a tech program that has like once a month catch up. I like that. So that basically I can go, can I just check? This 52-year-old has got this right. And they're there at 23 going, yes, no. And you go, thank you very much. That was so worth the 45 minutes we spent together.
Exactly. I'm now going to book my next flight to Thailand.
Exactly. Thank you. Yes. And in fact, I didn't. I use Arthur Online, and Ella, she emailed me going, where are you, Suze? I'm missing our call. Because not that I booked one, but I was away in Thailand, so I didn't do one that month. Yes.
Yes. Brilliant.
So, yes. I thoroughly think that investing in tech is a long-term investment that I didn't do early enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a lesson. And I'm sure there's plenty of other lessons that we'll cover. Yeah. Tell us about your best property deal. Make us feel sick to the back teeth.
Well, let me tell you about my best property model, which I hate to tell you, but I did multiple times. It's a 5-bed, 5-bathroom HMO. And you know, give or take, I've just rinsed and repeated on this model. So what I tend to have is I either have 5-bed, 5-bathrooms where one bathroom is the main bathroom. So one of the 5 bedrooms doesn't have an ensuite, or I have 5 bedrooms, 6 bathrooms. So you have a shared bathroom plus everybody has ensuites. But typically I have 5 beds, 5 bathrooms. And I just cookie cuttered and did this again and again. So lovely, good old roomy bayfront window, Victorian house within 1.9 miles of city centre, actually in a very desirable part, bought for £203,000, 41 grand refurb. At the time, I knew it was worth 330 done up. And now it's probably 525 to 550 easily, maybe even topping 575. And I didn't buy it with any of my own money. I bought it with an investor that lent me 100% of the purchase price, and a second investor lent me 100% of the renovation cost. So when you do 75% of 303,000, you pretty much pull out, except for the fees, all of the renovation and all of the purchase. So the first year, if you like, babysits the interest for those two investors, then it's yours for the rest of your life. So you babysit it for 1 year maximum. Yes. And I just did that again and again.
Susanna, I think you're reading my mail.
Why?
many, absolutely, exactly the same. Some, actually, we did 6 beds, many, yes. 5 beds.
Yes.
Probably, actually, it's so interesting, isn't it, to consider? And I often speak to people about the model of property, the actual property design in their area or where they're looking to invest. Because up and down the country, we have streets and streets of these Victorian terrace properties.
Yeah.
And I can, in my mind, I've been to Bristol a few times, I can imagine the type of properties that you're describing. And up here in the Northwest, I invest in Crewe and Stoke-on-Trent, again, a big railway town. So yeah. in the Victorian era, when they were building the railways, they built many, many, many streets of these terrace properties with bay windows. Don't look very big from the outside, but you step inside and you realise, woo, these properties go way back. And yes. They've got spacious bedrooms and they've got lots of lovely features and high ceilings and all these fantastic things that you can tick the box thinking, brilliant, I can put it on suite because I can drop the ceiling, I can put the drainage in, all the practical things that you need to cover are covered when you buy those kind of properties.
Yes.
And yes. You know, in Bristol you've got that kind of ability to do it because you've got enough provision of those types of properties, haven't you?
Yeah. Yes, we have. And so it's a rinse and repeat model where the en-suites are like Lego. They go on top of each other. And ideally, if you've got 4 rooms, you know, 2 and 2, then they go beside each other and on top of each other. Then you only need to worry about the plumbing on one other room. And maybe it's near the bathroom anyway.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Fantastic HMO model. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And you clearly, you know, cornered the market in that one. One of the areas that I often end up talking to my students about is managing builders.
Yes.
Can you give some tips to the listeners who might be enamoured with the model, but actually less enamoured with the practical outworking of doing this when working with a builder? What tips can you give us about that?
First is its numbers. For every good builder you're going to get, you're probably going to get 100 names. So just know that recruitment is 100 down to 1. Second, for me, and I don't know what your builders are like, the type of builder I typically got best outcomes from was, and it was all, so far it's always been men, so I'll just call it a man, a young lad who was probably 27 to 32, had done a really good quality apprenticeship with a good quality builder, have come out from underneath that builder and was starting out their own firm. So they're within a year or two of starting. So they wanted to buy business because they could not keep quality trades in their company or as self-employed, but direct contractors for them if they couldn't feed them work. So what you're doing effectively is you're kind of giving them the spine of their business, and their fat of their business is going to be somebody else putting in a 50 grand kitchen, whereas you're putting in a very cheap, or not cheap, but, you know, an inexpensive one. Mm-hmm. So you have a life cycle with those guys, because in 5 years' time, quite correctly, they should turn around to you and say, thank you very much. You helped me grow my business. But in all honesty, your work isn't very profitable for me. It just keeps my men employed. And now I've got a waiting list of 6 months. So goodbye. So know that there's always a life cycle. You will have an end date with every builder. Not that you're looking for it, but it's just a natural progression because you've caught them early. Then to always turn up on building regs, you would never, ever, ever, ever hand over building regs to a builder, no matter what they tell you, because they don't tend to like to work with building regs people. So just make sure you always turn up at the building regs meeting so you understand what's next. Have a contract, have a payment schedule, use the minor works JCB contract, in my opinion, and then have a snagging list. But pay them fast. Pay them the minute they're due. You know, don't delay.
Brilliant.
And never hand over final payment until you've got all your certificates. I have had from less good quality builders. I do remember a particular chap. He did have cauliflower ears because he'd done a lot of boxing. So he was a lump. And I remember him coming into my office. And he kept saying to me, it's in the post, it's in the post. I was like, absolutely, because I am as honest as the day's long. But I am not paying the final part as per contract until it's in my hand. Because once you've paid them, then, and I do remember him coming in and handing it to my bookkeeper and then watching her as she made payments. I didn't work with him again because I didn't like that kind of vibe. But that's a good description of really what you should be doing. I'm paying you the final part until I get my certificates.
And that's a great tip. That's great. And I think you have got to learn to be resilient and to be tough and to be assertive, yes, because otherwise people will take advantage.
Yes. Yes. You are not the path of least resistance. You are not the pathway by which water is flowing downhill sometimes. He wanted paying. I wanted to pay him. I wanted my certificates.
On that point, Susanna, over your years in investing in property, and you've worked with many different people, some who are more successful than others, whatever success ultimately means, it's a personal definition of that, isn't it? What do you think are some of the personal traits that help somebody to be successful in whatever way they design that to be in property?
The first is grit. Getting up after a knock. And that actually wasn't defined by me. There's a really interesting writer and academic called Angela Duxworth. She wrote a book called Grit. She's got, if people want to measure their grit, she's actually got the grit test. If you look up Angela Duxworth, it's the grit test. And if they want to measure grit against me, I'm 4.8 out of 5.
Oh no, there's a challenge.
Go on. Are you higher or lower than 4.8 out of 5? And don't wangle the test. Do it honestly. Years and years ago, I did an MBA at night school because, again, you know, head of household, I wanted to improve things for my family. And so I went on a Tuesday and Thursday to Strathclyde Business School to do my MBA. And the number one thing I recall from my entire MBA was that they'd done academic research on what is the key skill a person needs. Is it sales, finance, or whatever, to be successful in whatever business? And they concluded, get up after a knock. The ability to bounce back and get up after it's difficult. So I think grit first. And then the second thing, which sounds a bit of a cliche, but and might make somebody think, oh, I don't like that, is actually community. Now, I don't mean, you know, everybody loving and hugging and, you know, high-fiving each other. I've had very extrovert students who go and create great big communities and, you know, programs of their own, and it's amazing to watch. And I've had very introverted students who are much happier sitting in a darkened room going over their spreadsheets and processes, but they still connect with key people. So what that means for them is, A, they're able to encourage each other when it's going well and going tough, and B, they can reach out for solutions outside of their own sphere to somebody else who's probably at a similar stage and maybe just collected, you know, like Venn diagrams, got a little bit more information, a little bit more knowledge. So whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, to have a key community that you catch up with on a regular basis, I think is really important. Whether you buy into it with a mastermind or a mentoring program like yours, or, you know, I've got the academies, or whether you make it yourself. So going back to who inspired me, those four men, they were my community in the early days. You know, I was a bit wide-eyed and they were like, yeah. And I was like, oh, really? Yes. So I do think it's that kind of physical embodiment of somebody else who's done it, who can solve problems, and occasionally who can save your bacon. Now, I have paid back every penny of private finance and I borrowed millions. However, I had two very, not serious to the point of bankruptcy or anything like that, but nonetheless, I would term serious problems, i.e. I couldn't pay something back on time. And both times I launched, if launch is the word, hashtag save Susie's bacon. Very short-term, quiet fundraising campaigns to my mates with obviously legals and everything. And it was, help! The assets are there, the cash flow is not. I've overtraded, I'm an idiot. And that community, you know, one of these guys, you know, I was like, Anthony, I'm screwed. And he just gave me 30 grand immediately, which I paid back very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So not just to lean on them for cash, but that's a really good financial explanation of what they can do in other ways and you can do for them too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also the other thing, when if you're new to raising finance, if you haven't done it before, when you're already on the outside and you see other people, you hear stories like yours, it seems like it's impossible. It seems like it's alchemy. It's a magic trick. And actually, if there is something about the alchemist, about being able to raise finance, I think, because what you're doing is you're adding value to somebody else's life and they're trusting you. And to a certain degree, you're trusting them. And there's an awful lot of kind of subconscious bonds that are created in that transaction. And yet once you've done it once or twice, you grow your confidence, don't you? And tell us about when you first started having to do this, Susanna, when you'd run out of your own money.
Which was very early.
Very early. How did you start to raise money from other people? And did you feel that sort of change when you began to be able to do it and realize that you could do this too?
As soon as I bought that first one, bought for 80,000 worth 120 with a very quick, you know, turnaround, I realized that this was a fundraising vehicle as well as a mortgage vehicle. And part of that was my last job was I was marketing director of the SS Great Britain in Bristol. And when I got given the job, I applied for the marketing job. I also, somewhat unexpectedly, got given managing the fundraising department. And there was an amazing woman in there called Vanessa, who was much more skilled at fundraising than me. In fact, I proposed that she become a director of fundraising because it was silly me just repeating what she told me in meetings. She should come to the board, and she did. And so I actually learned the skills from a different industry, from somebody who was just superb in that industry. So I had the basic principle of you make a case, you ask for the money, it's a numbers game, and you monitor and measure, but it's also a personal relationship. Obviously for fundraising for a charity, they don't give the money back, but with high net worth individuals. So I could see that it was a possibility to transfer to property if you could refinance and rent out and pull all the cash back out. So very quickly, I think my first joint venture was about my fourth property. And my third property, I fully funded through a private finance. Because I pulled the cash out that first little one, bought a second one at auction. Then the third one was fully funded private finance. And the fourth one was a joint venture. Amazing. And then the fifth one was fully funded private finance. And then we went on that way.
Yeah.
But I think, sorry, jumping in. But I do think a person should only do it if they're super nervous. Like if you've got, the minute the person writes the check, your voice can't speak because your nerves have constricted your throat because you're so paranoid about their cash.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm officially terrified, because the responsibility. And I never took more than 20% of anybody's fund. Again, I would have loved to, I would have loved to. But what if I'd made so many mistakes to the point that the money had been lost, which is, of course, a possibility. That responsibility was too big for me.
I think the way that you describe that shows you've got incredible integrity, Susanna, which I think that the property industry as a whole often lacks, certainly on an outward facing level. There's many people doing what you've described with integrity, but perhaps they're not singing and dancing about it. And so people don't see that this is the way that a good property investor grows their business, is by doing it with integrity, with trust, with get out clauses, with contracts, with paperwork to back it up, with security, keeping to the FCA regulations, etc. That's the way to actually build up a group. And actually, in my experience, you don't need a lot of people. If you've got a handful of high net worth friends, you can build as big a property portfolio as you want. Yes. It's all down to your own desire. Because once you've got that group of people, I had a phone call from a friend just over a year ago, who, in fact, no, it was probably about 8 months ago. And her mother had some money in savings that wasn't giving her a very good return, because this was before interest rates started to go up. Although even now, compared to what we give her, she still wasn't getting a very good return. And she said, "I want you to borrow the money, Wendy. I want you to take the money."
Yes.
Now, at that point, I didn't really have a project I could put the money into. But she insisted, "I want you to have this money because I know that you will find a home for it. You'll give us a good return." Yeah. So I thought, well, this gives me impetus to go out and find something. So I went out and found an auction property, and using the finance from this particular individual, we bought the auction property. It's now worth 100% more than it was when we bought it. It was exactly doubled in value by doing very little to it. It was just an absolute steal at the time.
Yes.
Carried on giving my friend's mother her interest, because she does not want the money back. She wants the interest payment. But the great thing is, we could use that time and time and time again for other projects.
Exactly.
Now, how many of those, if you're working full time or part time, or you've got children, or you've got the time you have in a week is not endless. You've got to pick and choose how you make your money grow in the most efficient use of your time. So having a tap, if you had 10 taps, you'd be overwhelmed. Yes. And I've often said to Andy, two or three taps is all we need. And sometimes we've got to turn those taps off because we actually don't want any more outside finance. But people don't always kind of get that. But it's what happens, isn't it?
Yeah. And once a person trusts you, I always paid interest on a monthly basis, which was a standing order. One of my investors once said, "Oh, Suze, you're so good. None of the other people are lending money to pay me on time." And I was thinking, it's a standing order. It's actually not me. But once the person trusts you, very rarely do they pull their cash back out. Very rarely. And a small tip, because people in property tend to overpay interest, at least, I did at the beginning as well. And so I would do year contracts, and 6 months in, I would say, "Look, in 6 months' time, because I've bought a lot more property," and I would show them the properties and show them the spreadsheets, I'm less of a risk. So I'm reducing down from, say, 12% to 10% to 8% to 6%. But I gave them 6 months to choose. And I say, do you want a month to think about it? And maybe we could catch up in a month. So they're not feeling their arms. So it reduced the cost to me. Nobody pulled their money back out. I wasn't messing them around. They were still being paid way more than the interest rates. And it was true. As I became safer, quite correctly, their risk reduced, and therefore their reward just gently reduced as well. So it saved me a lot of money.
Nice. I like that. I'm going to be phoning my friend's mother straight after this recording.
Sorry.
No. Whoops. Great tip. Thank you, Susanna. Let's talk about the future for you.
Yes.
You're in a lovely place right now. I can tell that. You're shining. You're looking absolutely glowing. What do the next 5 years look like to you? Where would you like them to be? What would you like to do?
So I think I'm in stage two of what I would think is a three-stage process. I'm a little tiny bit in stage three, but mainly in stage two. So stage one is acquisition. Stage two is paying down. And then stage three is paying for things with cash. So I've paid down multiple properties. I've paid for properties with cash. Now, some of your listeners are going to be throwing their hands up in horror, saying that's a terrible return on capital employed. And I'll go, "Oh, no, but it's great." It's so secure. And I'm a little rebel. I am incredibly grateful to the banks, but also I don't like paying them. So really for me, it's to continue stage two, which is paying down more properties and then buying more properties with cash, because I don't want any funding in the end. I don't want, I do 5-year fixed mortgages. I don't want any faff and hassle for having to refinance. I don't want to have to pay, you know, significant XYZs, you know, fees and blah, blah, blah. I want to be entirely free manning my own ship. And I'll be living half in Barcelona, half in Bristol, traveling the world, which is kind of what I've been starting to do anyway, because I own houses in both places.
By this stage, your children are independent of you, I take it?
They are. Does anyone else have 20 children who definitely think and probably feel and definitely know that they know best? I'm at that stage. So we had no rebellion at all as teenagers, and we're having a little bit now. So yeah, my children are thoroughly independent right now. My mum's a ninny. Breathe and say, I kind of remember being like that. So yes, right now they're forging their own routes. My son wants to go into property. My daughter's in online work. I did have a boomerang where one came back because things hadn't worked out particularly. And I do anticipate once they have found their footing very strongly, very much helping them with property. But right now they definitely know best.
Absolutely.
I think genuinely they need to learn some good life lessons, and then you know, my son said to me, Mum, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. Now I actually spat my tea out in surprise, because he doesn't remember from the age of 10 to the age of 20 the deep struggle his mum went through. He doesn't remember the cash flow issues. He just knows that mum's a multimillionaire with lots of properties. And he's worked for me every summer throughout his college. And then he renovated my flat in Barcelona. And so there is a risk, actually, for those lovely young people that they've got to learn their own skills as well. So I'm stepping back and I'm breathing.
Well, that's wonderful. You can almost say your job is done.
I think I'm going to come in with some deposits, but once they've just kind of practiced life on their own a little bit more first, and then I hope that they would ask me to come in with deposits. But once they've had that practice of being skint and having to get a second job and, you know, all of that stuff.
Which, let's face it, was the pain that you faced that actually launched your career in property. And had you not had that pain, would you be where you are today?
No, I'd have been sat very contented watching more television.
So to a certain degree, I think there is always this risk, isn't there, that when we've made money as parents, we tend to want to cascade that to our children. But actually, often I'm in my own mind wondering, is that the best thing for them? And in fact, we have only done a little bit of it to help them, because my two eldest boys have got property of their own and my third son wants to invest in property. And to be fair, we will probably gift him a small deposit to enable him to get started. But I very much believe that they should stand on their own two feet, because it's not so much actually about the money. It's more about the drive to make it happen. And as you've mentioned today, those personal skills of resilience and grit, which are so vital for them to develop. And if I am always stepping in and helping them, how are they going to develop that grit?
That's right. But for the last 6 months, he and I have, until like a few months ago, we were doing weekly mum mentoring calls where he was going through my program online and he was asking me questions. And I'm really happy to transfer what you might call technical professional knowledge and be a sounding board. So I struggle with this because, of course, they're my babies and I want to look after them. But The best way I can look after them is to allow them to look after themselves.
So you're in the next few years, Susanna, you've got a whole range of assets. You've got property assets, you've got family assets, you've got relationship assets, and you've got your own health and your own well-being as an asset as well, which is a big part of your life as well. I know that you take it very seriously. Interestingly, about paying down the mortgage on your properties, I've had a number of conversations with people who are doing exactly the same as you, partly as a reaction to Section 24, but also partly because leverage is effective when you can utilize it to grow your business, and when you can utilize it to, secure those assets. Yep. But I think probably in every property investor's kind of own life cycle, there comes a point where you think, actually, I don't want the risk of for example, interest rates. I don't need an excessive amount of property. You know, if I can make 20 or 30,000 pounds a month from my property portfolio, you know, how much can a girl really spend? Well, I know that probably we can all spend more than we get.
And I went to the top tailor and had an entire new wardrobe, so I could answer that.
Yes.
Nine cashmere coats and about 30 or 40 silk garments that were all tailored. So quite a lot. But nonetheless, I hear you and I'm with you. Yes. And because I had those health issues, every 3 months when I got scans that were good, I bought another piece of gold jewellery, which, to be fair, you know, we go back to the girl that only had £10 a month. I didn't do any of that stuff, but I was holding on to it like the way the Egyptians or the Romans did. It was my talisman. You know, it was the thing that got me through the MRIs was I've decided what I'm going to get next. But yes, no, I am with you. I am with you. For me, I'm a good quality portfolio, but fundamentally a lifestyle rather than empire builder. I salute the energy. You know, I've got great friends who are empire builders and I love their energy and I love their dynamism and we have great conversations. I just came back from a 6.5 week trip around in Thailand where I just noodled around and enjoyed myself. You know, I'm off to my home in Barcelona. Life is very important to me. But that doesn't mean to say, I mean, I'm going to run a whole series of flips to bring in more revenue. I'm going to be the funding partner of a whole series of joint ventures. My property profits pay down my houses. I'm moving into commercial. So I'm not stopping, but I'm not running out the gate doing 200 deals in 4.5 years now.
Yeah.
Because I'm at the next stage.
Fantastic. That's something for us all to aim for. We'll be watching you closely, Susanna. Right.
Mainly on the beach. Yeah, sorry.
great for your Instagram feed.
Well, do you know what it was? I woke up just before COVID. I was in Barcelona where my son lived at the time. We'd had a beautiful time celebrating my birthday. It was the Monday was my birthday and he had gone to work and I had a gorgeous time with him. So I was very happy, but I was a bit like, oh, I'm on my own. It's my birthday. And I'd always written in my plan, because I've always had a written plan. It's always been very visual for me. I'd always said a flat in Barcelona. And so I just went, I'm going to buy myself a flat in Barcelona. But you know, when you just talk nonsense to yourself, you're daring yourself and you didn't really mean it. And then the second estate agent I went into found the perfect flat for me because my son had already told me which area. And I was like, okay, I'll buy it. And then you're like, whoops. So I think plans are great because they're there and then you slowly realize, oh, it was part of the plan. It actually has been part of my plan for 10 years, but I was just sort of, I'll do that.
What a great feeling, a great feeling of freedom.
And bought it cash with what? With money I made from property. You know, so yeah, property works.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Well, Susanna, it's been absolutely fantastic. This podcast could go on for another 2 hours, but I'm conscious of your time. And I'm conscious of our listeners as well.
Yes, that's very true. Sorry, guys.
No, it's great. Absolutely great. Fantastic quality and lots of amazing content. Just can you distill, probably not very easily, but just try, could you distill perhaps 5 tips that you might give to aspiring property investors, perhaps people who are listening to this podcast because they're toying with HMOs or maybe they've started to invest in HMOs? What are your top 5 tips, Susanna?
I got 5 practicals and 3 mindsets, but I'll distill them very quickly. So on the practicals, I'm a practical girl. I'm like, get it done, you know, is write your plan. Definitely get help, you know, from somebody ahead of you. Understand the metrics that you need to measure. Number 4 is measure and then improve. So that's basically plan, do, review with some help. And constantly just beat that, you know, be on that. And then on the kind of more mindset is, as I did with David and Nigel and Anthony and Lee, get to know people who are ahead of you, but a few, or I felt there were many rungs ahead of me at the time, but get to know real life human people who breathe and drink tea, who are ahead of you. And you think, oh, they can do it. Know why you're doing it and then have your plan be visible. So that flat in Barcelona, actually, it had been written on my plan for 10 years. So that was more the mindset. So there you go, 8.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, you can have 8. I'll give you 8, Susanna, because you're so wonderful. And actually, those are all incredibly good tips for somebody. And really keep doing that. Those are tips for life. However new you are, however experienced you are, those can work for the rest of your life. So that's amazing.
I agree.
Listen, Susanna Cole, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on today. Thank you so much for your words of wisdom, your openness, your vulnerability, touching on many different parts of your life, sharing yourself as an entrepreneur, businesswoman, and also a mother. It's been an absolute delight to have you. Thank you so much for being on the HMO Success Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. We could, couldn't we? We could.
Yes. Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.